My name is Dave Hart. I'm from the University of Calgary, but more importantly, I was on the Institute Advisory Board for IGH for the first 9 years of its existence.
And I'm really pleased to be here at the conference because I think it really shows how the IGH has been able to build a community, a diverse community, but a real community where none existed before. And I think that's a very important testimonial to the Institute and the efforts of our scientific directors and the dedication of a lot of people on the IABs. It's my great pleasure today to introduce our plenary speaker, Dr. Paula Johnson. And I'll just hit a few of the highlights of her career. She is a graduate of Radcliffe College, received her MD and Master's in Public Health degrees from Harvard. She's an internationally recognized cardiologist and founded the Center for Cardiovascular Disease in Women at Brigham and Women's Hospital in 2000. She also founded the Gretchen and Edward Fish Center for Women's Health, which serves as a basis are a base for research to improve women's health and health care. In 2009, Dr. Johnson was named to the Advisory Committee on Women's Health, Office of Research on Women's Health at NIH. She was also appointed to the Boston Public Health Commission in 2007 and has served as the chairperson of that commission. She is currently executive director of the Connor Center for Women's Health and Gender Biology, as well as Chief of the Division of Women's Health at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and an Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. She has brought her broad range of expertise and experience as a physician, a researcher, and an expert in public health and health policy to the Connor Center. The Connor Center works to transform the health of women through discovering how disease manifests differently in men and women, as well as integrating leading-edge research regarding women's health into effective delivery of care. The center is unique in its innovative and interdisciplinary approach to women's health, which influences health policy. It also addresses the health of women globally and trains the next generation of leadership in women's health. As a result of her accomplishments and contribution, Dr. Johnson has been the recipient of several awards and is featured as a national leader in medicine by the National Library of Medicine. It is clear that the product of research is knowledge at multiple levels, and the conversion or implementation or integration of that knowledge into practice and affecting the lives of recipient populations is key. Dr. Johnson has been and continues to be a leader in this area, and today she will address us on that topic, from knowledge to action, using sex, gender, and health research to improve policy and practice. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Johnson.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hart, for that very generous introduction. And as we begin, I do want to thank our online participants who are with us from afar. Well, I just want to say it is such an honor to be here today, and I want to congratulate all of you on this amazing 10th anniversary. I think that the Institute really serves as an international model for the way we absolutely need to approach the study of sex and gender in health and in medicine. As you know, in the United States, we have an office, And although the office has done remarkable work, you're having an equal seat at the table and being able to work as a true partner across the institutes, I think advances the work in ways that maybe even you might not even recognize, given that you live in it, but I view from the outside. And I just want to say congratulations again on 10 years. I want to start, this is something that none of you need to see, right? But I always start here because I think that, especially after 2 days of digging so deeply into the topics you've delved into and thinking at these levels of science, of biology, of health, of integrating across disciplines, just to come back to the fact that sex does matter. Gender does matter. Every cell has a sex. There are sex differences in health and disease, that models of disease are not based on women, that gender plays a very significant role. And I think for us in the United States, it has only been since 1993 with the NIH Revitalization Act that was mandated, passed in Congress, and mandated the NIH to include women and minorities in studies that were funded by the NIH. Now, I want you to see the language. It's to include women and minorities. It says nothing about analyze by. It says nothing about understand the effect of. It's only to include. And so when we think about where we are today, I want to read to you some of what kind of we're grappling with, I think, as a community of investigators, of clinicians, and those passionate and interested in this topic. Even though it's been almost 20 years since this mandate, when we look at clinical trials in cardiovascular disease, that, and I would probably say cardiovascular is one of the main areas where we actually have made a bit more progress than in some of the other areas, but when you look at cardiovascular trials, only 24% of the trials that were actually published through about 2005, 2006, only 24% actually reported their results by sex. 24%. So they included women. The majority included women, but only 24%. Autoimmune diseases. These are data from the recent Institute of Medicine report looking at women's health research, really setting the agenda for women's health research. Autoimmune diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis and lupus are more common in women. Yet, it takes an average of 4 years for a woman to get a diagnosis, of a correct diagnosis of an autoimmune disease. It takes her an average of seeing 4 physicians in order to get the diagnosis. And over 45% of the women who received a diagnosis of autoimmune disease have been told that they were either chronic complainers or were too concerned about their health. Now, I'm not going to go through a whole number of areas, but it gives you a flavor of we've come a long way, but how much more do we have to go? Because if we think about autoimmune diseases and disorders, there's so much more we have to learn about fundamental sex differences. But then even for what we know today in terms of differences in the rates of diseases, we are still not translating those findings into clinical care. In the United States, 1 in every 5 women who delivers a child has at least one pregnancy that's complicated by preterm, preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, or hypertension of pregnancy. These complications increase the risk of future heart disease from 2 to 3-fold. And I would venture to say if there are any clinicians in the room, maybe not in this room, but if I were in another room, in terms of routine primary care, most of those questions are actually not asked when you see your doctor. I don't want you to think about your own experience. If you've seen a primary care doctor recently, and this is not the fault of primary care, but how do we begin to understand what we are finding from the science and translating that into clinical care where we know risk has been impacted. Around the world, one woman dies every 60 seconds, and 15,000 women every day from pregnancy and childbirth-related complications, and 1 million children die worldwide each year because their mothers have died. Another major global problem, not the only global problem that affects women, but clearly a major one that I know has been addressed today. What is the repository of knowledge that we have to address maternal mortality and its effects? How do we begin in a much more collective and robust way to advance this work? And lastly, even though we are on the cusp of kind of the revolution, right, of personalized medicine, I think that's what we're all calling it, personalized medicine, there is very little impact or discussion of sex, which is, quite frankly, the most fundamental biologic difference, and is fundamental to personalized medicine. And last week I was giving a talk to an organization in Washington, Grant Makers in Health, and it was last Tuesday, and the New York Times had a big section. I don't know if anyone saw this. The New York Times special section on what's next. It was the predictions. What's next? What are the big things on the horizon? And it gave all the predictions, and in fact, it discussed Alzheimer's disease, it discussed mood disorders, discussed a number of other areas, stem cells. There was not one mention of sex. And we all know, if you're talking about Alzheimer's, if you're talking about mood disorders, if you're talking about stem cells are sexed. So lots of work to do. And today, what I'd like to do is really provide a bit of an additional framework of thinking about that translation, that interplay between knowledge, care, and a more active agenda around policy. And then through this all, thinking about the next generation. So I know for this group, women's health is a magnifier and a multiplier. I put this slide in here because it is the way that I usually build some momentum, not in this crowd, but in terms of speaking, because we know how to speak to each other. Frequently, it's speaking to everyone else who's not in this room that is the bigger issue that will truly be the way that we begin to change some of the things we are talking about today. Women remain the primary caregivers around the world. They're the doctors, the nurses, the pharmacists, and the therapists. Women in the United States, at least, make over 70% of the healthcare decisions, and I bet that's probably not dissimilar in Canada. Women are demanding consumers of healthcare. They seek more health information, demand more education, press for prevention. Women are the bearers of the next generation. Healthy women produce healthier children. And the health of women, I think most notably, is a key indicator of a country's overall economic health, educational health, and health overall. So, thinking about women's health, I like to think about this over the lifespan, and this is just to put a visual up here across the lifespan, all the way from fetal development to aging, and then obviously affecting the next generation. And as we talk today, I'm going to use a few examples to kind of put this framework kind of into a reality, kind of a little bit of a case in a couple of areas, but thinking about health and well-being over the life course. And then this morning I heard quite a bit of talk about the need to work across fields. And this isn't even, this is a slide that I use just to think about across these various disciplines, and they are not just pillars, right? But women's health really, or sex and gender medicine, runs across these various fields, is inclusive of obstetrics and gynecology, but clearly across cancer, cardiovascular, neuroscience, in orthopedics and arthritis, and we can also begin to create intersections between those, because we know that the brain, in fact, really affects cardiac disease and is key in cardiac development. So we have to not only work across these areas, but also understand the intersection among them. And then this is the framework that I'm really going to be working off of for the rest of my remarks, which is women's health across the disciplines. And up in the left-hand, I think it's your left-right, the left-hand corner is research. We must produce and disseminate scientific knowledge on women's health and sex and gender-based biology. That research must inform clinical care, which is over to the right. And as we come up and develop these models of care that are based on the science, they help feed additional science. It's not one or the other. It's the back and forth. Key in this is educating and supporting leaders of change. So as opposed to education in sex and gender-based biology or in women's health, I like to think about this as of leaders of change, because it's not only change and advancement in this discipline, but it is a whole new way of thinking. It is thinking across disciplines, it's thinking across platforms, and it is really helping to develop the next generation that can also think about what the meanings of their findings are when it comes to policy. And policy is the next area down in the green to the left. How do we use what we're learning in science and use our experience in the clinic to actually help policymakers get the best information to inform their work moving forward, as opposed to only advocating for very small specific areas or having advocacy groups that are very important partners for us. But I think we as an academic community have really a lot to offer our policymakers in terms of grounding their future work, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then last but not least, developing leaders in global women's health. How do we really think about leadership across disciplines that will advance the health of women globally, not only in our backyards and places that are potentially underserved, but around the world? So it's just our framework, with the center being the transformation of the health of women. So my first example that I'm going to talk a little bit about is lung cancer. Lung cancer is the number one cause of cancer mortality in the United States for both men and women. It frequently is not discussed as a women's health issue. You see here lung cancer is 42% of the cancer deaths. That's both the light blue and the dark blue. And if we look at the dark blue segment, those are the women who are non-smokers, okay, who develop lung cancer. And of the non-smokers who develop lung cancer, women are 60% of that population. Overall, this disease is one in which we have done quite a bit of work, obviously, on risk, the major risks being smoking, but then there are a number of environmental risks and risks that we fully don't understand, particularly given this whole area of non-smoking women. But an area, once again, that has been relatively ignored, at least in the United States, in terms of the advancement of science. But what we do know is that women with lung cancer tend to have a tremendous psychosocial overlay with the disease, particularly if they were smokers. There is a sense of guilt. Women are more likely to have ignored their symptoms leading up to their diagnosis. And with a younger population being diagnosed with this disorder, with this disease, there is a growing need for a different level of social support for the population. So although the science needs to be advanced to understand underlying mechanisms, there clearly are needs that women have that need to be focused on. So we developed a program for lung cancer in women, and it's a clinical program that addresses the medical and psychosocial needs of women, and it has become a way for us to not only galvanize interest and support for the entire spectrum from prevention all the way through diagnosis and treatment, but it has also become a very important focus point for additional investigation. So just to test us, as we think about this program, in the past month, the biggest, one of the largest kind of news stories has been the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial and its results. This was a trial that was funded by the National Institutes of Health that enrolled both men and women who were at high risk. So they had to have had a 30-pack year history of smoking. And they underwent CT scanning to screen them for lung cancer. It turns out the trial was stopped a bit on the early side because screening was effective. Now, how many of you in the audience actually saw those reports, saw that in the news? Didn't make it to Canada. That's amazing. It was all over the major news stories in the United States. I can tell you from where I sit, the study has not yet been published. This was a pre-release. There had not been one mention as to how the test did by sex. I have no idea when the study is published. It will be published in a stratified, with results stratified. But here are some of the gaping holes that exist, even as we think about our media picking up stories, because no one then asked the question, how did this do in men and women? But I want to say that creating a forum, creating a focus of this area on this underserved and underexplored area began to actually pick up the questions through our own institution, and we actually were able to begin to get this out to the media and got a little bit of traction, at least, in this particular area. Providing the infrastructure for discovery. Now, through this practice, what we've been able to do is actually seed a data and tissue repository for different types of lung cancer. One of the types has been mesothelioma, particularly rare. Most common risk is asbestos exposure, but there are a few others. Only 20% of mesothelioma sufferers are women, but it turns out that women actually have do better with mesothelioma. The question became why, and I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but about a month ago, what we've discovered is that, in fact, there's an estrogen-regulated gene that's associated with mesothelioma outcome. Far more common in women to have this gene, but interestingly, when men have this estrogen-regulated gene, their outcomes are more like women. And as you can see, by looking at the sex difference, by using a clinical difference that we were looking for in women, we were able to go back, look for the science, and actually from this, what we would hope is opening up additional fields of study and maybe even models for other forms of lung cancer. And lastly, working in this field in this way has also enabled us to partner with not only investigators, but with clinicians, patients, and advocacy organizations to bring the issue of lung cancer to policymakers, I think truly in the form of the Lung Cancer Mortality Reduction Act of 2009. And just to give you a little bit of the work that we've done, which is called Out of the Shadows, Women and Lung Cancer. It was the first report definitively kind of created to focus on this disorder. We took this to Capitol Hill with our advocacy partners, partnership between clinicians, investigators, and once again, advocacy groups, to bring information to those who have been on the front lines from a policy perspective. And I can tell you that even though there have been people in Congress, like Dianne Feinstein of California in the United States, looking at this issue, they have not had scientists and clinicians sit with them to talk with them about the knowledge gaps, about the true stories of being on the front lines, and of what science is on the cusp of being able to learn and help to inform. Only if we could get additional funding, additional focus, and a focus on sex differences, which is actually now in this bill. So I think it provides us with understanding a clinical difference, developing a clinical model, using that clinical model to advance science, and using all of the above to advance the policy agenda. The next example I'm going to talk about is heart disease. More women die of heart disease than men each year. That's predominantly due to the fact that women do live longer. And we know that symptoms are different. And of men and women who die suddenly, 64% of women versus 50% of men had no previous symptoms. We're not going to go into all of the reasons we think that might be the case, just to say that there are these sex differences in cardiovascular disease. There are race differences within the female sex, and I think this is something that I know has been discussed time and time again through this conference, but it is so critically important that we begin to think about women's health, about sex differences, but we really integrate that thinking with racial and ethnic disparities as well as other disparities in health and disease. But as we can see, if we look at the death rates, black women, this is in the United States, have the highest death rates, with white women being next and third being Hispanic women. Once again, risk is, we tend to think about risk in that later course of life. So menopause and older, women develop the disease about 10 years later than men. The numbers begin to truly increase after the menopause. But we also know that risk starts early. And risk, we're now beginning to understand, starts not only early, as I mentioned earlier, in the reproductive years, with risks such as preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, et cetera, but risk also is increasing or is impacted by what happens in the uterus, in the womb, during fetal development. Lots to learn. So what do we know today about some of the fundamental biologic differences in heart disease? This is a cartoon, and I'm sorry I can't point using the pointer, but I'll walk you through this. There are sex differences in the physiology of myocardial infarction or heart attack. And these aren't set in stone. I mean, men and women can have either, but it is more common for men to have something called plaque rupture. This is an artery in cross-section. So this is if you're looking at an artery, a long artery is cut in half and you're looking at what's going on. The red in the center is where the blood is. That yellow is the plaque. And the plaque, when under the one that says plaque rupture to your left, the plaque has in it a necrotic core, and those bluish cells are inflammatory cells. And what we now know causes a heart attack is that there's a rupture. Okay, if you can imagine that plaque almost having a smooth surface, there's a rupture in that plaque, a thrombus forms, okay, a collection of white cells and platelets, et cetera, forms, and it obliterates the lumen of the artery, and you get a heart attack. Okay, so that's the most common form of heart attack in terms of looking at autopsy studies. There's another form, another underlying physiology called plaque erosion. And in plaque erosion, which is you have the same plaque, you look at the plaque there, you've got the necrotic core, and you have a little less in terms of inflammatory cells. But instead of having a fissure, okay, or a rupture in the plaque, there's an erosion on the top of the plaque. And in the end, at the end of the day, a thrombus, okay, you can almost think about it as sandpaper. That sandpaper forms kind of a sticky, rough surface, and you have white cells, platelets, et cetera, sticking, forming a thrombus, and the end result is a heart attack. Both look the same phenotypically. Okay, person comes with a heart attack. You don't know whether they had plaque erosion or plaque rupture. Most of the models that we've discussed are in science really have to do with plaque rupture. Plaque erosion is far more common in younger women who have heart attacks. Do we understand what the underlying physiologic difference is? We don't today. But what that says is that there's so much opportunity for learning and knowledge, because today we treat all heart attacks in the exact same way. Is that correct? We don't know. And in fact, younger women with heart attacks actually have a higher mortality rate than their male counterparts. So if you're under the age of 50 and have a heart attack, your mortality rate is higher. Is that because you just have more risk factors and you start out being sicker? Or is it because, in fact, the underlying physiology might be different? Today, we don't know. So I think there's tremendous opportunity moving forward as we think about what we see in terms of clinical outcomes and how that informs science. Another area of physiologic, kind of the phenotype of disease that is different in men and women, and this one will have a direct clinical application, it is that when we think about blockages in arteries of men and women, now this is now an artery, the top one is an artery in long section, so imagine an artery and as opposed to cutting it in half, we're cutting it in long section. The yellow is the plaque going across the entire artery. and the red is the blood going into the artery. If you look at the pressure curve on the bottom, that is the pressure of the blood going through, measured going through the artery. And as you can see in the top picture, in the top cartoon, there's a very discrete blockage. Can people see that? And what happens? The pressure goes down right after that blockage because the blood can't get through the blockage. This is traditionally what we think about as coronary artery disease. You could imagine if you put dye in that artery, you would see that blockage because the dye would fill up the space of the blood, and you would put in what we call a stent or a small mesh tube. It would open up the artery, the pressure curve would be fixed, the patient would be fixed, and they go home and they feel better. Well, in fact, for many women, and men get this as well, but it's far more common in women, disease is not seen in this way. If you look at the bottom, which is more common in women, you see disease across the entirety of the artery. Now, take a look at the pressure curve at the bottom. The pressure curve ends up in the same place as the one above it. But if you put dye into the artery below, what you're going to see is, in fact, it fills that space where the blood is, and it may look like there's actually no disease. When, in fact, when the patient on the bottom exercises, she will not get as much blood as she needs to the heart, just like the patient above, but in fact, she may undergo the definitive test and may be told that she is fine and coronary disease is not her problem. So what might this look like in a true heart? Now, I'm not going to make cardiologists out of you, but this is our definitive test today. The standard test that we use is called a coronary angiogram. The picture to your right, to your left, I'm sorry, is a normal coronary artery. You can see they look nice and smooth. I'm not going to tell you which arteries they are, but they look nice and smooth, kind of blood, you know, the dye going into these major arteries. And the diseased arteries, you can see in the picture next to it. And I think everyone can see where those blockages, right? Can everyone see that? Good. If you look at a patient who had a bit of what I showed you in the cartoon on the bottom, okay? This is a patient. This is a real-life patient. She's given me total permission, and she's actually been very public with her experience, and this is not a unique experience. This is a person who had a number of risks for coronary disease and, in fact, had had a prior stent placed, so she had known coronary disease. She was a landscape architect. She began to develop recurrent symptoms, could not work, and lived alone. She was dependent on her only income. She had seen several physicians and had actually had several cardiac catheterizations and was told that her symptoms were not due to her heart. This is what her catheterization looked like. And as you can see, I'm going to show you what point A and point B looks like. But if you look at it, it doesn't actually look that bad, right? The blood is flowing through. It looks pretty normal. But there does look to be a little bit of lumpy bumpies maybe that don't look quite as they should. And I'm going to go to B first because what we did here was this is an artery. The outside highlighted area is the actual wall of the artery. The next layer that you see, which is kind of the next darker layer, is blood. And that center, very black-appearing hole there is actually an ultrasound catheter. And what we did was we put an ultrasound catheter into her artery, and the ultrasound catheter allows us to look at the artery from the inside out. So at B is actually normal. And if you can look, the wall of the artery, the outside part, looks normal. But at A, we realized that it didn't look quite normal. We looked at that, and as you can see in A, to your left, there's a lot of abnormality in the wall. And when you measure across the pressure across that area, in fact, this patient had about a 75% drop-off in blood flow. And although it was very hard to diagnose from a traditional cardiac catheterization, with using standard and, in the United States, reimbursable technology, we were able to make this diagnosis. And a stent was placed, and the patient went home, and she's fine to this day. Now, we've created protocols that actually do this on a routine basis for both men and women when there's a question. So it's not for everybody. It's for when a person comes in and their clinical symptoms or test results do not match the findings. Now, why is that important? It's important because if you don't think about sex differences, or if you don't believe, and there are many who don't believe there are sex differences in coronary disease, you will never get to the point of creating an opportunity to go to the next step to actually make a diagnosis. And I would say that this is now done routinely in about 4 places in the United States, but only in 4. There's tremendous opportunity. So how should we be thinking about this? I like to think about this as a learning practice model, which is we have research. Research, and we need more, obviously, to increase our understanding of sex differences in health and disease. We need to continue, obviously, to expand inclusion of women in research and clinical trials. We need to expand reporting of results by sex, race, and by sex, race groups. But we absolutely need to be learning from that experience and translating and developing models that incorporate those learnings into clinical care, effectively translating research into clinical care, using sex-specific data to consider the safety of interventions and the effectiveness of interventions, and then really thinking about sex-stratified quality measures. So at every level, thinking about sex in our clinical practice. And then as a supporting structure, how do we think about using both the research and the clinical practice for education and awareness, and not just for patients, but education and awareness for women, for investigators, for physicians, and other healthcare providers? Because if we're not talking to our physician and other healthcare provider colleagues, that research is not going to be incorporated into new models or our quality colleagues. And clearly, amongst our patient populations, having the knowledge, the patient I just gave to you actually had the knowledge through looking at some websites to go looking for other opportunities for a diagnosis to be made. So I think this paradigm begins to really put forth a way for us to be thinking about clinical practice and research in a much more closely aligned way. Now, I'm going to go back for a few minutes to pregnancy as a stress test for cardiovascular disease. We know that pregnancy is a stress test, but for your average normal person, they survive that stress test. It doesn't have a significant impact, and their cardiovascular disease develops as most would later in life. But we know that for example, with complications such as preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, et cetera, that stress test achieves a different level of risk and therefore increases risk earlier and in a more intense way as life goes on. Now, what do we know about these areas today? Well, we have a lot to know, but I'm going to focus on one particular area, gestational diabetes and its associated risk, because I think it provides another opportunity for us to think about advancement of research, advancement of science, and how we think about building the field. If one has gestational diabetes, I remember when I was training, it was decidedly a disease of pregnancy. And if you got through it and were okay, then you'd never have to think about it again. Today, we know through research, okay, through things, studies like the Nurses' Health Study, for example, that the risk with subsequent pregnancies is 50 to 65%. We know that 50 to 70% of those women will develop type 2 diaabetes over the life course, 20 to 30% will develop type 2 diaabetes in 7 to 10 years, and we know that there's an increased risk of type 2 diaabetes in the children of mothers with gestational diabetes. And we know that event-free survival, okay, that's what this curve is, for women with gestational diabetes is lower than those who did not have gestational diabetes. But where are we today? We are at a place where there are no guidelines in the United States on how to care for women either pre- or post-pregnancy to decrease risk of this very prevalent disorder that, in fact, has race and ethnic disparities as well. There's currently no formal method to track the population who has this disorder through billing, which is the way we tend to track disorders. There is no diagnostic code for gestational diabetes. And it clearly means that given the risk, we need to address the full scope of cardiometabolic disorders in younger women who are pregnant or soon to be pregnant that affect the health of women and children across the lifespan. Getting back to this, how do we begin to develop models of care that include this kind of risk knowledge that can then help to develop the guidelines, that can then help to move us to a very different level of even tracking this population? We are in the midst of developing some of these models at our institution, but I would put this forth as a challenge for us to think about how we integrate this kind of thinking into care. Once again, across the lifespan, both for ourselves and for the next generation. One of the ways we need to be thinking about this is, what is our research effort writ large? How do we understand not only these factors, but the impact of the social and environmental aspects of health and disease? And one of the areas that we've been very focused on building is what we call a family cohort that would include a number of thousands of women, children, and families as they come through pregnancy, delivery, and age with social and environmental data, tissue data, to understand questions like, why do pregnancy complications predict early mortality in 25% of the mothers who experience them? Can we design a novel cardiovascular screening system to follow women who have complex pregnancies? What are the intersections of psychological health and physical health? And how do they differ for men and women? All questions that if we are ultimately to achieve health, we must answer. So once again, opportunity as we think about large initiatives in our institutes of health. How might we move these agendas forward? So thinking again about our interdisciplinary effect and model and how we move various agendas forward, I want to talk a little bit about the social and environmental context of health. We know that women are more likely to live in poverty in the United States. And here's the curve in poverty predominantly, with the sex differences in poverty predominantly occurring in younger women and in older women. But we frequently sit in our offices and talk to patients as if they were all coming from the same places. And how might we integrate this knowledge, even at the bedside, about the social and environmental context in the day-to-day recommendations we provide? And once again, I'm going to talk about heart disease, but I want to talk to you about a small study we did that had very significant impact, and it grew out of women's health. It's not fundamentally women's health, but it grew out of women's health, which is thinking about poverty, thinking about nutrition, healthy eating, and thinking about who controls the table most often. It's women. We decided to look at the affordability of a healthy diet in low-income neighborhoods. We looked at a number of focus groups and decidedly developed culturally appropriate heart-healthy menus, and we did this for a group of African-American women and a group of Latino women. We did cost assessments and then really looked at what it would cost. And what we found was that in a poor Boston neighborhood, if you were a single senior, and you know a lot of the single seniors happen to be women, you were, and if you were on a subsidy called food stamps, you were allowed $242 a month. And what it cost was $242 a month for healthy food. If you were on food stamps, you were given $139 of food stamps per month. Clearly, there was a deficit. If you looked at something called the economics efficiency standard, which is what do we need to live truly in the Boston area, you were allotted $178 for food. It still didn't reach that $242 that we believed was the lowest common denominator of what it costs for us to achieve a healthy diet in the way that we recommend to our patients. And I'm not going to go through all the details, but basically the same was true for a family of four, and we did it with a number of variations of a family of four, young children, older children, et cetera, a deficit. Now, what did that mean? How do we kind of take that and think about its policy implications? Well, this work then led to a number of coalition partners who were very interested in issues of hunger and obesity. Obesity, also a greater problem in women. Brought them together to begin thinking about, with the city of Boston, how we move this agenda forward with regard to healthy eating. How do we improve access to healthy food and safe environments? And in collaboration, there were a number of grants that were achieved throughout the city to improve accessibility with small things like using your food stamp card at a farmer's market. So small changes that can make large differences. But ultimately, what this really did was lead to a policy change in the city, which developed a food policy council that is taking on this issue in a very significant way. So I want to bring this example forward because I think that we can use women's health not purely for the sex and gender-based differences that we tend to talk about, but we can use that lens, that social platform, to address issues that are clearly important for our communities, our states, and our country, and as a way to move these agendas and get traction on these agendas. And I also want to put forth that some of these agendas really lend themselves for us to develop new models that live at the intersection between healthcare delivery and public health. So if we think about this healthy eating example, I sit in my office and we see obesity and diabetes presenting to the office, which is on your left. But in the communities, we see obesity and diabetes presenting as major problems in our communities. How do we bridge that gap and begin thinking about models that help us address the need to access healthy and affordable food to address these problems? How do we bring these communities together? And I would say that at the output, we have improved access to healthy, affordable food that is supported by the physician's office because we now have appropriately developed menus for different racial and ethnic groups. May not be appropriate for everyone, but it's surely better than the bland kind of singular sheet we would give patients. We have information regarding where you might access healthy food, what farmers markets are available, and this is in a physician's office. And quite frankly, we have healthy food supported by our community, all supported by legislation that occurred within the city. But the thinking began in a singular office, thinking about sex differences. So I think an opportunity, once again, for more expansive thinking, and this is just another schematic for us to think about this intersection between public health and healthcare delivery, that I think women's health is ripe to help drive this kind of change. So I'm going to say a couple of words about policy and advocacy. Many of you know in the United States we've been on the cusp of healthcare reform. You have a national system. We do not. In Massachusetts, where I'm from, we actually instituted more of a system of kind of a meld of private and public, but there had been no look at sex and gender in how we were doing in Massachusetts. We've focused on this area and actually have now begun to use our findings to inform health policy or healthcare reform on the national agenda. And I would say that even though our system is quite different from yours, I would challenge us to say, can we use women's health as, once again, a lens to drive change, in our health policy, in the way that we think about healthcare delivery. So just a few areas, we're using women's health as a lens in which we can define a strategy and framework for creating an effective women's health implementation agenda, and that's the Affordable Care Act. Examine the infrastructure intersection of women's health and health reform. Synthesize work being done by the federal agencies and identify gaps. Translate evidence into action. Defining a research agenda. So I think you get the point. Women's health can be used as a driver for implementation change as we think about health systems. And it's a way to galvanize support. And I'm just going to end, because I know we want to leave a few minutes for questions, in thinking about global health. I love to put this end quote here, as Hillary Clinton said, In the new global economy, individual countries and regions would find it difficult to make economic or social progress if a disproportionate percentage of their female population remained poor, uneducated, unhealthy, and disenfranchised. And today, I don't have time to go through some of the work I believe women's health can really drive, okay, to improve the health of populations globally. But we should be thinking about that framework and lens of women's health, not just maternal health, but of women's health as a driver of change. How do we build that next generation that is able to address those problems? What is our repository of knowledge around improving the health of women globally in all of its complexity? It's not just about healthcare delivery. It's not just about public health. It's about the law. It's about education. It's about economic development. But how do we begin to understand those intersections and all of their complexity to advance the health of women and thereby advance the health of all? So I'm going to end there, and I'd be happy to take any questions. And I'd like to thank those who are online who have joined us for this part of the presentation.